Inside COVID-19 from BizNews. Well, one of the great things about doing this podcast is that you get to talk with South Africans who really have made big strides on the international stage. Amongst them, Professor Linda Gail Becker, who's Professor of Medicine at UCT and the Chief Operating Officer of the Desmond Tutu HIV Foundation. Prof, it was interesting for me to discover your involvement with the International AIDS Society as a past president, also that it organizes the biggest gathering of any developmental congress in the world. I guess the story now is that if there's been such a huge effort, more than 11,000 members of that society on HIV/AIDS, is there any way this can now move across to the COVID-19 arena?
Certainly, I think this is exactly what has happened. Those who are watching what's happening in the States will see our czar, who really leads the AIDS world, Anthony Fauci, has been appointed by the United States president to lead the COVID. And all around the world, infectious diseases doctors who've been caring about HIV have pivoted on a dime, literally, to take on the COVID question as well. And many of the resources and the foundations we built over many years, 35, 40 years, are also now in place to be used to make sure that we can hit the ground running with COVID. Urgency is the big thing with this pandemic, and so there is no time to waste. And so I think in many ways, that's the silver lining. We weren't completely unprepared. We do have people who understand infection, we understand infection control, and we understand the sort of societal impact of a pandemic like this. And I think that's been really important. In this country, of course, Salim Karim, who for many years has been devoted to HIV, also has been at the front line. So, you know, I think that has almost been the thing to do.
Given your background and very close relationships that you have in the United States and on a global stage, have you been able to use much of that communication, perhaps in a local sense?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think this has been the extraordinary thing about this epidemic compared to, say, 35 years ago with the AIDS epidemic. I can't help drawing the parallels constantly in my mind. If you think about social media, 35 years ago was frankly non-existent, you know, and we were very dependent on peer-reviewed publication and newspaper reports. Now it is everywhere, and it's almost impossible not to be watching on a day-to-day basis. In fact, the big thing these days, as you know, is sorting out what's fake and what's real. And I think that's really important. I think that's an important role that people like me can play, is to try and help the public understand what is real and what is nonsense and what they need to be listening to, because they now have this incredible access to so much information. I mean, it's been a tsunami of information that's been coming to us. And the nature of the epidemic, of course, because it's been a wave around the world, we have been able to look north and see what's happened in the north. And in some ways, that's helped us prepare in a better way for what was coming for us. Because, of course, we were all completely in the dark 6 months ago. We had no idea. And even today, there's a lot of dark matter out there. There's a lot about this pandemic we don't know. And we're literally sailing as we go and, you know, learning as we sail, I should say. You know, I think it's been extraordinary, incredible amount of information coming in on a daily basis.
Where the tacky hits the tar, though, in the communities themselves, you do have an advantage given what the Tutu Foundation has been doing on HIV/AIDS. Have you been able to switch that over to focus on COVID-19?
Yeah, I think, you know, right from the get-go, my biggest concern has been the unintended consequences of preparing for this pandemic. I mean, there is no doubt that needed full attention and a lot of energy. But I was very worried about the aftermath. And that aftermath could include a resurgence of HIV, an uncontrolled TB situation. We've already heard reports that childhood vaccinations have fallen away. The utilization of everyday other services have reduced. And so because HIV sits squarely in my forebrain all the time, and I'm always worried about it, I have immediately set to work to say, how do we make sure we don't drop the ball on HIV? We're in a precarious place here in South Africa where we have the biggest HIV epidemic in the world. We have a very, very real TB epidemic. And that dual epidemic mustn't be forgotten in the flurry and the, you know, the anxiety around COVID. And so we in our organization tried to very much lead the way to say, we need to bring COVID into our menu of services rather than stop the bus and build new set of services around COVID. And so that's exactly what we did. We quickly adapted our sites to become COVID ready or COVID safe. And that meant infection control for an airborne disease. Now, we've for many years worried about universal precautions when it comes to blood and body fluids, because that's how HIV is transmitted. But now we're faced with an aerosol droplet and aerosol source. You have to put up other kinds of infection control measures. So we quickly developed work practice guidelines and SOPs. We obviously got the personal equipment that was required, built infrastructure, barriers, Perspex screens, that kind of thing. On our mobiles, we've again modified the mobiles so that people can safely interact with each other without worrying about aerosol transmission. And we carried on. And that's the important thing, is we've gone back into the field. You know, hats off to my team who have controlled their own anxiety and said, you know, we have a job to do. We've got to get out into the field and we've got to continue to do what we've been doing to date. And so our services continue. And I think that's really important. But now we add COVID to the menu. We make sure that those individuals who are symptomatic get tested. Those people who need referral into healthcare get referred. But in the meantime, we continue to look for those folk who need HIV services, sexual reproductive health services, contraception, PrEP, all the things we've always done. And that's been the difference. The other big thing is we're, of course, waiting for the vaccine trials. And so my sites have also prepared themselves, and we'll pivot directly into testing new innovation, pre-exposure prophylaxis against COVID, as well as new vaccines and monoclonal antibodies, which hopefully are on their way. And we expect, well, as listeners know, we've already got the first one set forth in Johannesburg last week, and we're expecting more of those candidate vaccines to hit our shores, and we'll be testing them as rigorously as we've done all the testing we've done in HIV to date. So we're ready for the task, and we have the troops to do it.
Are there any of those pre-exposure prophylaxis that you can apply? I know this is an area of specialization that you've been.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously there are two approaches to this. The one is you formulate new agents, but that's going to take a great deal of time. So what we're doing at the moment is running through various drugs, various interventions, even nutraceuticals. People will have heard about artemisinin last week. Chloroquine was very much in the news, hydroxychloroquine, vitamin C, vitamin D. You know, we're looking at all these possibilities to say, what is the biological plausibility here? What do we see in the test tube? What impact does this agent have on SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, in the test tube? And then we're saying, well, can this be applied as a pre-exposure prophylactic agent in a human being? Then obviously we have to go into the phase twos and the phase threes studies to say, in a randomized controlled way, can we show impact? Because if we can, maybe this is an agent we can use as a prophylactic. And clearly for healthcare workers, this is a great way to go. We know that healthcare workers are highly exposed. If we can get a prophylactic agent into them, that could enforce or add layers to their personal protective equipment, which is so important. And we absolutely advocate that every healthcare worker should have access to PPE. But obviously, if there was something else they could be taking as well, that would be terrific. And so we are moving to those trials. We had pinned our hopes on chloroquine. Unfortunately, it looks like chloroquine isn't going to hold the promise we hoped. But there are other agents that are in the pipeline. And we've set up an important testing platform involving healthcare workers, and we're ready to go to test the next agent as soon as we've got the approvals that we need.
What about the debate around BCG, the vaccination that we all have here in South Africa? Mm. We know that there is a trial going on in Stellenbosch at the moment. Is there any further update on whether or not this is acting as a prophylaxis?
Interestingly, BCG is amongst a group of vaccine candidates for this action. On that list is oral polio vaccine, the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and of course, BCG is there as well. So what the principle there is that when our immune systems work to fight viruses, we use a whole slew of different parts of the immune system. By vaccinating with something that isn't specific to SARS-CoV-2, it hasn't been designed to set up the immune system in an adaptive way to go for SARS-CoV-2, you stir up non-specific immunity. So other parts of the immune system that just picks up, hold on, there's a foreign antigen in the body, I want to overcome this. It isn't, as I say, directed at SARS-CoV-2, but it's other parts of the immune system. And that's what those vaccine candidates will do. So as I say, BCG is one of them, and there certainly is some biological plausibility there. Oral polio vaccine would be another one. MMR is another one. And we may well put those into our armamentarium. Of course, BCG is very familiar to us all. It's a vaccine that we use in our neonates to a high degree. We also have a lot of circulating tuberculosis, obviously, in our community. So I think, you know, we have to do the human experiments to know whether it is going to work or not. That is the bottom line. And so, you know, hats off to the team who are doing the trials. That's going to be another piece in the puzzle. And we're going to have to quickly move to test these various pieces in the puzzle to figure out which one is going to be the home run.
Is there any thoughts that you can share with us on why South Africa's mortality rates are so much lower than those in the other parts of the world right now?
Yeah, so Robin Wood, my husband, and I have been really thinking this through a lot to understand, because they actually look like they could be dropping compared to, say, what was seen in Sweden. And it's not to think countries to the north of us have got worse health system or had less understanding. You know, I think there are a number of theories for this. One is that maybe we just have a younger population. We know that COVID is more serious in the aged. And, you know, perhaps the virus is encountering fewer older people in that regard. I think we have learned a lot more about the virus. I think the honest answer is the jury's still out on this. I don't know. I've heard another theory that maybe the virus is in some way being passaged, and now, you know, maybe more infectious but less virulent. I think all of us are somewhat in the dark, but I'm very relieved that our mortality rates are much lower than what we're seeing, say, in Italy and Sweden, which I think was really horrifying. And certainly, I think got all of us very anxious about what was coming. Clearly, any death is one death too many. But, you know, I think the country has done an amazing job of setting up field hospitals and responding to the epidemic in all kinds of ways. So, you know, I think it's also important to remember history. The flu epidemic of 1918, you know, decimated, I think it was 6 million South Africans. We have lived as a humanity with pestilence for a really long time. And I think this is our lot in a way. Obviously, we have to try and be prepared in a better way for each of these pandemics, but I'm pretty sure there will be more in the future as well.
Given the work that the foundation does in poor areas or areas of extreme poverty, you would have a better insight to what's going on there right now with COVID-19. Is there anything you can share with us on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I can say is that I think our requests for people to physical distance and, you know, to try and self-isolate take on enormous complexity when you move into our peri-urban, urban, crowded environments where people are living under difficult circumstances at the best of times. We're moving into winter now when we know that harsh conditions exist in those high density crowded areas. And, you know, you add something like this, I think it's incredibly hard to say to people, look after grandma, try and self-isolate, practice hygiene, wash hands regularly. If you're sharing a tap that is outside of your home down the road, you know, what does that actually mean to individuals? And I think that reality is a stark reality, which needs to be factored into the equations as we think this through. So I think it's probably not a surprise that the virus has been moving very quickly through those crowded communities. And it's an infectious agent, and that thrives in close spaces with poor ventilation where a lot of people are in contact with each other. I mean, in some ways, it infuriates me to see that people are going to political rallies in America where they have a choice to go into those crowded spaces. You know, for our communities, often there is no choice. And that kind of makes me angry at some level, because I think where people have fewer choices, we need to respect that and understand that. But I think also, maybe if, you know, if we had this to do again, we would think more carefully about the kinds of advice we would give for those crowded environments versus a blanket. And I think we've learned this in HIV. When we started out with HIV, if you remember, it was ABC. Everybody had to abstain, be faithful, or condomize. And it was this broad, you know, message that went and fell on people to whom it wasn't relevant in many ways. Over 30 years, we've learned that our prevention message must be more tailored. We've got to do this for this population. We've got to do that for that population. And in a way, people can adapt and adopt that more easily because they say, oh, that's relevant to me. I understand that. This is my risk profile. I can understand how to adopt that. And I think maybe as we learn more about this, we can begin to refine our prevention messages. We're already knowing, for example, that young people are far less at risk of COVID. Do we have a different message for those young people than we do, for example, for the elderly or those with comorbidities? Are there a different set of prevention measures we need for folk in old age homes compared to, say, the broad general public? And maybe if we can apply ourselves even in our crowded environments, is there something we could have done where we go, okay, this home has an elderly citizen in it. Do we need to do something different in this home versus, say, somewhere else? So we could be more nuanced in our approach. And that's been going over in my head a lot. I don't have the answers, but I think that kind of nuanced, you know, beyond the panic, the initial emergency, if you like, can we begin to get more nuanced in our approach? For example, masks, you know, when we started with the whole cloth mask thing, first of all, you know, do they work? Don't they work? Now I think, again, there needs to be a bit more of a nuanced message about when are they important and when are they not? When you're on your own in fresh air, you know, that mask probably isn't terribly useful. But if you're in a crowded space, if you're at, you know, at the supermarket, then yes, you must wear a cloth mask because you are protecting others and others are being protected from you. And therefore, it is important to do it in that setting. But I see folk going for a jog, you know, on the mountain with a mask on. And I think, oh, shame. I'm sorry for that because it feels like they're inconveniencing themselves without a rationale behind it. So I think we could get more nuance in the application of prevention as we get to know this epidemic better. And as I say, you know, that's growing logarithmically on a daily basis.
In other words, more sophisticated in our management, less panicking. When we talk about panicking, and you did mention briefly the politicians, in the United States, we've had some very strange thoughts. Not least the video that went viral of the president, Donald Trump, saying that you can inject disinfectant into yourself. You spoke about fake news. How much damage does that kind of a messaging do?
I think it's incredible because for some reason, and I say this respectfully, politicians, you know, do hold an enormous amount of sway. And that's worrying, you know. And so I think those countries where they've quickly organized experts who really understand pathogens and disease and got those people to be the frontline spokespeople. I think that's in a way been helpful. And where politicians have decided, you know, I need to step away from this or at least listen to the experts, unless, of course, they are experts themselves. In this country, we're lucky. Our health minister is a medical doctor. I think that's been very important. And I think our president has done a wonderful job of patently listening to experts and then conveying a message. But clearly, politicians, people listen to what they say. And if they're saying the wrong thing, that's incredibly harmful. Again, I'm in the old school of the people who should be speaking about this are the people who know what they're speaking about. And, you know, of course, there's been a real concern from where I sit, where there's been in the need for urgency, there's been a slew of non-peer-reviewed publications coming through. And that's partly been because people believe, you know, we have a responsibility to publish as soon as possible. But I'm the old school that really believes that it's important we, as scientists, check each other, that we hold each other accountable, that we review each other's data, and we then say, this is fit for publication, or have you thought about this, or have you been objective enough? Have you thought? And that process, unfortunately, has got a bit screwed up in the sense of urgency and panic. So I think we have to step a little bit back from that and say, not, you know, somewhere there's a middle road to this where we can be urgent, but not frivolous or careless. And we continue to hold each other accountable to what we are saying and doing.
So as members of the public, what can we believe and what shouldn't we believe? Can you give us some insights?
I think any new innovation is not ready for prime time unless it has been through a rigorous clinical evaluation. I think that's a good bottom line. So the chloroquine story will forever be, I think, a salient one. There was biological plausibility. We knew that chloroquine could work in the test tube, but it was important to put it into, if you like, the human experiment under carefully controlled situations for us to understand what was the harm on the one side and what was the benefit on the other side. And as it turns out, in high dose, the harm outweighed the benefit by far. And at lower dose, probably the benefit is not going to be enough to get up and apply it in big doses around. It's a fantastic drug for malaria. It has huge application in rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases. It doesn't look like it's going to cut it for SARS-CoV-2. And there are some trials still ongoing. And so maybe, you know, we still need that final word. What is the effect? There may well be a small effect. You know, and then we're going to have to decide, is that small effect sufficient? But definitely in higher dose, the harm it causes appears to outweigh the benefit. And that we only discovered by running good randomized controlled trials. And had we not done that, we may well have had more harm than good if we had just rolled it out, as was, again, unfortunately promulgated by various political leaders. And even today, there are some who still believe we should be doing that. I think that's a huge mistake. So I think the public need to be skeptical. I always say there's value in having a healthy dose of skepticism. Do I really think this has been adequately tested? And then there are some reliable sources on the internet. There are names that come to mind, Mayo Clinic, for instance, or you can go to those kinds of more household names that mean a lot. And then, of course, our own household names, NICD, Department of Health, those kinds of websites are more reliable for sure. When it comes on as an ad in social media, I think beware, check it out, ask, call, phone in. Check it out before you buy either large loads of it or take something that could cause harm.
Just to close off with, South Africa is now having the fifth most daily infections or fifth highest daily infections in the world. It seems as though the Western Cape was just a reflection of what's going to happen elsewhere in the country. But how are you reading this?
Yeah, I mean, the question that comes to my mind again is why did Cape Town takeoff first. So again, these are gaps in our knowledge. I don't think this is something we're withholding, you know, we know and we're withholding that information. I think we just don't understand why it took off. Was it because it came into our communities first? And so this is merely a timing thing. Is it that our, you know, winter hits a little earlier here? I actually don't know. And I don't know that anybody knows this. It's clear that Gauteng is now taking off, as you say, in a big way. I would be wrong to say I have the answers to this. I think we'll need to reflect for a long time hereafter. Maybe I'll make one other comment. I think modeling has in some ways helped and in some ways been quite problematic in the approach to this epidemic. One models when you don't know and you're trying to predict. But then as you go, obviously, as new data comes in, you have to validate those models with the real data as it comes in. And then ultimately, the data itself is the thing you base your assumptions and your predictions on. So we saw as well an enormous slew of models. And even today, I'm hearing all kinds of dire predictions. I think to a certain extent, we frankly need to be honest enough to say we don't know. And this thing is kind of charting its own course in many ways. I'm grateful that we had those few months that we could do some preparation. I think our health systems could at least gird their loins, as it were, and prepare themselves. But in many ways, it will do what it seems to be doing. And we're just going to have to, as a nation, brace ourselves for that and stand in solidarity, particularly with the healthcare workers and the frontline workers of the country, and hope, you know, it'll move on and come to close with as little morbidity and mortality as possible.
Inside COVID-19 from BizNews.